The fact that there are two is casting a shadow from my buddy. My buddy in London is transmitting to me. The signal is going through the Con Ed wires, and what gets sifted through that wires comes into my dipole. Those Con Ed wires have a couple of square feet of area, which is equivalent to their physical area because it's non-resonant. A couple of square feet of shadow, but the rest of the signal that wraps around the Con Ed wires goes through those wires, hits to my dipole. My dipole has 8,500 square feet, and I get that signal. If I could run the experiment where I first look... If I run the experiment where I first listen to my buddy in London under normal conditions, and then in theory I go out there and convince Con Ed to take down that wiring, and I repeat the experiment an hour later, so to speak, assuming the propagation didn't change, and I measure the signal strength before and after, there would be an extremely small fraction of 1 decibel of difference between the Con Ed wiring being there and not being there. It's casting a shadow of a couple of square feet on an antenna that's got 8,500. Once you realize what real radio area is, if I now built myself a Sturber curtain of some other kind of... If I built myself a parabolic dish on 80 meters and I make it 31 feet in diameter, I'm building a real big radio telescope and I'm using it at a real low frequency, 3.5 megacycles. Diameter parabolic dish. Assuming I've got $1 zillion and I can do it. You know, I'm the owner of Facebook. I've now got $1 billion and I decide to build a 131-foot diameter radio telescope in my backyard, assuming my zoning board will let me do it. I've got to buy a great big piece of property to do it. And I compare the signal I get from the 131-foot diameter parabolic dish to that simple wire dipole. The signals will be almost identical. Ain't that crazy? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the SECNET.
KC2WGB. Oh, Dick, I know you're absolutely right, but you have to admit, at first light, it's sort of counterintuitive. More area, you should have more signal. But very good point. Okay, we've got to pick up Paul. That's about it from Mel's Corner, and we'll continue next week with this. But let's pick up Paul and see what he's got for the space report. KC2WGB, I think K2RIW.
You sound like you got a chuckle out of that one, John.
Dick, I sure did, because I know exactly what he's thinking, because I thought that at one time. Wow, you know, the more area, put up a fishnet, of course you're going to get more signal. You're capturing more waves, aren't you? So how does that work? Well, you just explained it.
Well, I've given the beginning of an explanation. There's a lot more going on. As you can tell, radio is strange. There's a lot more surprises as to what Mother Nature is really doing. That's sort of what's going on at CERN. As they dig down and find out what's happening at the molecular level, what's happening at the wireless level, what's happening at the ionospheric level, what's happening at the center of the Earth, what's happening at the center of Mars. Mother Nature did not design this universe to be simple for us to understand. She gave us one hell of a challenge. But I think there's been one more delay on the launch in space of SpaceX, and give us some words on that one, Paul. WS2N, hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz. K2LIW and the Tech Man.
WS2N, we're still here. And yes, they it was like a night launch, you know, or morning anyway. It was dark in Florida. And they had the, and went right down to the last second, the engine started to fire, and the center engine wound up having high pressure, and it was shut down right there on the pad. So, you know, they call it the Falcon 9. That's the rocket and the Dragon sitting on top with the cargo. The Dragon part that's going to go to the space station. Well, the Falcon 9 sent the rocket number 5. Started to go up in pressure. Since then, they started to work on it and take a look at it. There's a check valve involved in these all these rockets, and they think there's a faulty check valve which is not acting the way it's supposed to, allowing the pressure to creep too high. So they're going to change out that. Let me drop it. If that doesn't work, they could change out the engine right there. They have that capability of doing it. So they're planning on launching on Tuesday, on the 22nd. And again, early in the morning, this time 3:44 in the morning. It has to be an exact time. The space station is at a certain location. It's not like launching to the moon or Mars. You know, they don't have much of a window. A 1 second window. That's it. And if they miss that, they'll have to do a delay. So that's the story, and I've been delayed many times. I think it originally was supposed to go up in February and in April. And they had a lot of software problems. They're trying to straighten out with the Dragon spaceship, making sure that, you know, it's autonomous system of aborting would work properly in case there was a problem. So let me drop it to WS. So we're looking forward to that. I recorded that, and we'll just put that together with the actual launch when that happens. I just wanted to mention one other thing. I didn't have much tonight, but there was an amateur space satellite that was launched with another satellite. They do that quite often. You know, if there's room on board, they'll put a smaller satellite on board, and that's what this is. It's one of these things, you know, maybe, 3 feet or 2 feet cube type of thing in the picture I saw. And it was launched from Japan. It's built by Japanese students. It's going into a sun synchronous orbit about 600 kilometers high. And they're really running a test. They're trying to see if they can get the voltages up on the solar panels that are on board this thing. The highest voltage so far achieved in, you know, with the solar panels in space or from the space station, usually you're maybe 160 at a high point, around 200. They're going to get the voltage here up to 300. Let me drop it. And from what I've read on their website, they're running 5 parallel strings and 4 series strings to do it. Not sure exactly what they mean by that. You know, I can see them ganging some panels together in parallel series, but how they get to up to the 300 volts, I don't know. And that's really the test. But on board is this amateur transmitter, transmitting on 437.375 megahertz telemetry coming out, and AX 25 and also FSK frequency. Frequency shift king, but on that same frequency, 437.375, they also have a CW beacon coming out at 20 words per minute, and they're looking for amateurs to listen to that, see if they can hear it, send in reports. So, pretty interesting. The batteries on board are nickel metal hydride. There's 3 big batteries on board. Each one, right down here, 1900 milliamp hours, so for a total of 5700 milliamp hours, and that's pretty much it. Very low transmitting, only 1.1 or something, roughly 1 watt of transmitter power going into this thing. So that's the story on this satellite. It's cool. Let me drop it. I guess it's pronounced Hoyo, H-O-R-Y-U, too. So it's Hotel Oscar, Romeo, Yankee, United, too. I first heard about it, ARRL sent out emails. Probably a lot of people got this. And then I just researched it a little further to get the additional information. Back to you, Dick. That's pretty much it for the space report, WS.
The HORYU-2 satellite was launched when, Paul, and what's the predicted lifetime? And I presume if I go to AMSAT, I will get the Keplerian element so I know how to track it. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, you can get all that information on a website, HTTP://KITSAT, K-I-T-S-A-T, KIT, because it was being, was really put together like a kid. Dot E-L-E dot K-Y-U tech T-E-C H dot A-C dot J-P, that's for Japan, slash index dash E dash new dot H-T-M-L. But it's a lot easier to put in H-O-R-Y-U, the name of the satellite, too. The research satellite. It was launched on the other day, May 17th. And, with solar panels, I guess it's going to last a long time. It's 600 kilometers high. It's not going to run into too much atmospheric drag, so my guess it's going to be up there a long time.
So this thing is a transmitter with AX25 and prick to shift keying. Is it also a repeater, or is it only a beacon? I'm guessing it would sort of have to be a repeater, a satellite-type repeater. It's not a LEO, low Earth orbit. At 600 miles, I would call it medium Earth orbit. It's a MEO. So is it a repeater, and what is the uplink and downlink? Over to you, Paul.
I just think it's a CW beacon, and the telemetry coming off of it is also on that same frequency, 437.375. Running 1200 board AX.27 packet telemetry. And it doesn't sound like it's a repeater at all. Just a beacon. They'll be sending the information down on that, on those packets, on the voltages and everything that it's generating. So, unfortunately, it's not one of the ones that we could work. Very small. I mean, if it looked like 2 foot cube, it's a lot. Has some information. There are only 30. That's small. 30 centimeters cube.
Wow, that's roughly 1 cubic foot. Very close to 1 cubic foot. Interesting. And the fact that it's up at 600 miles means that it'll sweep across your horizon to horizon a hell of a lot slower. Is the orbital period... See, 90 minutes is a low Earth orbital period.
I think he said 600 meters, Dick.
At 600 kilometers, Dick.
Okay, 600 kilometers high. All right, that's more like 400 miles. That's still a lot of altitude, though. That's going to be up there for a long time. Is the orbital period something like 2.5 hours instead of 1.5 hours, Paul, if you happen to know?
No, I didn't see that, but it's you get up that high, it's going to be a little longer than 90 minutes, but I don't know if it would go that long, 2 hours, wow. Maybe 2 hours, 90 minutes, yeah, an hour and a half. Yeah, maybe it might get close to 2 hours.
It turns out that orbital period is a function of radius cubed. You got to measure the radius from the center of the Earth. See, as far as a satellite going around the Earth is concerned, it thinks the Earth is a point source. In other words, it acts with a couple of minor perturbations. It thinks that all of the mass of the Earth is grouped together as one golf ball right in the center of the Earth. And so the distance between the satellite and that golf ball, you change that distance, and the timing squared equals radius cubed is the way the ratio works. So it changes pretty fast as a function of radius. When you do a little bit of a burn of a satellite in space, and you make a couple of meters of change in the altitude of the satellite, you'd be amazed what it does as far as catching up or slowing down with another satellite in front of you. The orbital mechanics is such, let me drop this, that when the Falcon 9 and the Dragon are launched, they've got to be launched in a very short period of time window, because it's very similar to what happens if you study all of the paths you take with your automobile. You study all the paths that you take, and you realize that you've got a zillion places where you could have an accident every day. There's cars crossing in front of you, making turns in front of you, joining your street and whatever. All kinds of things are happening. There's lots and lots of places where you have a crash. You don't have a crash because even though both of you pass through the same point, you and that other car pass through the same point on the exact same road, we don't do it at the same time. Same sort of things going on when you launch something to catch up with the International Space Station. Unless you want to burn a whole lot of extra fuel changing your orbital period, altitude, position, and whatever, you've got to launch at a very particular time so that at the end of that launch, that's where the International Space Station is. You want to end up at that particular point in space as a target. And you launch, let me pick a number, since they're moving at 17,500 miles an hour, I'm going to round off the numbers, that's in the vicinity of 20,000 feet per second. 20,000 feet is, 4 miles. Every second that you delay in the launch of your spacecraft from Cape Canaveral, every second that you delay, you miss that point in space by 4 miles. And you're trying to get within feet so that you can dock with them. You can see what's going on. You can see why there's some very narrow windows. Yeah, you can do some adjusting on the way up because you know you launch late or early. But every second before you start burning extra fuel and making orbital corrections,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
Every second that you delay will make you miss by 4 miles. I wonder if anyone's ever discussed some of those details, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I remember that years ago with the early flights, you know, when think about Mercury, Gemini, and early Apollos, and they were almost on 24 hours a day, you know, all the way through Apollo 12, and then they sort of cut back. They used to talk about the window, you know, and some windows were very short, and this one is like, you know, to the second, like you said, you know, I mean, if it don't go, when it's supposed to go, it's not going to go. Sometimes the shuttle used to have that had a little bit more capability. They could wait an orbit for the space station to go around again and then launch again. They'll have to wait. And it gets pushed back. You know, they had a launch of the Soyuz going up there, and when there's another spacecraft on the way, they don't have two at the same time, so it got pushed back all the way into May. And here we are getting to the end of May. So, everybody said, let me drop it. The government, you know, every time we launch a rocket, it's delayed. You know, it was a lot of problems for quite a few launches over the years, no matter what they were launching, the weather or technical problems. Well, why don't the private corporations do it? You know, they would do a better job. Well, as you can see, it's their Mercury time. You know, they're having difficulties. And it's not an easy task to get things up off the ground going at that speed. And eventually when they break Earth orbit to go to the moon or to Mars, they have to go 7 miles, 7 miles a second, 25,000 miles per hour to do that thing. So I remember that one from years ago from the Apollo days, 7 miles a second.
Which, as I remember, is Earth gravity escape velocity. And you've told us last week, and I've forgotten, the Curiosity is going to be landing on Mars, I think it's August, and what date in August, and roughly what hour is it atmospheric encounter where we can start watching television and watch those guys chewing their nails at Pasadena, California, at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Over to you, Paul.
I think that was August 5th, UTC time, early morning, you know, probably 3 o'clock or something, which would make it. I mean, if that's the case, it would be August 4th here, late at night, probably 10 o'clock at night or something. That's my guess. But we'll see. There's a lot of mid-course corrections that have to be done. I think, there were six planned mid-course corrections. The first one they skipped because they were on target. The second one they did it not too long ago. So that means there's four more planned. And that will change things one way or the other, either accelerated or deaccelerated, and that would change its time frame. But it's a 50-mile footprint that they want to do in Gale Crater. So let's see how that goes. That's going to be something to talk about a couple of months from now.
When you study how big that thing is, how elaborate it is, how complicated is that atmospheric encounter and landing procedure, all of those various squibs have to fire just right, all of those parachutes have to deploy, and you can do some minor testing of all of this hardware, but let's face it, they never really used that hardware, that procedure, encountering the Martian atmosphere. You can do some of this as simulation in computers, but you're making a whole bunch of assumptions. You think you know the density and altitude of the Martian atmosphere. You think you know what the local weather is going to be like that particular day. You think you've done all of the right navigating with all of the right mid-course corrections. Tell me, are you a little bit worried like I am as to whether or not all of this is going to go right? This is a one-shot deal. There's only one spacecraft. A lot's riding on this one. A lot of money involved. And a lot of things have to go just right. If any one of those steps has a hiccup, the chances of recovery are not so good, particularly in view of the fact that everything you watch on the screen at Pasadena, California, all of that information is already old news. And, you know, it took, let me pick a number. It took 15 minutes at the speed of light for the signal to travel from the spacecraft to where you are. The whole landing sequence is a small fraction of that. So everything you watch, even though you're going to be biting your nails and watching in what you think is real time, at the time that you're watching it, it's already game over. The real spacecraft, in real time, if everything goes right, is already on the ground saying, hello, I've arrived, and Houston, the Curiosity has arrived. How are you? Are you at all as concerned as I am, Paul, of US2N, K2LAW?
I think they got a handle on the atmosphere and the weather. Don't forget, we've had so many spacecraft that have actually gone through this procedure and landed, either, you know, crashed or landed, but there's a lot of data that has come back. And then you've got all your satellites that are presently in orbit. You've got the European there. Mars Express, that thing's still in orbit, sending back information about the planet, the density, the humidity, and whatever, you know, the wind. Same thing with the Mars Global Surveyor. I think that thing's out of commission, but we've got Mars Odyssey, that's still working. And you've got that gigantic thing up there, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. And that thing is doing the work of all the other satellites combined. I mean, even when Phoenix went and landed in the Northern Hemisphere, that was the one that landed. That just had three legs on it, no wheels. When that parachute opened up, Mars Global Surveyor, let me drop it. Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter took a picture of it. You could see the parachute. You know, boys, I mean, it wasn't live, you know, we didn't see it happening, but that's the kind of photography that they're doing. You could see spacecraft on the planet that have landed there. You could see, they have pictures of Spirit and Opportunity on the ground. You can actually see the shape of it. So the quality is really good. The technical part, I know they've tested these things probably hundreds, maybe if not thousands of times, parachutes and all these different things that have to be cut, cables, data cables, the suspension cables, this thing's going to come down like on a sky crane and be lowered down, and the thing's got to be cut just at the right time. It's got all kinds of radar and everything, and knows where it is. So I think they'll have a shot at it. It's a lot better than, let me drop it, better than taking these things and bouncing them across the planet. I mean, that must be some vibrations this thing is going through. I mean, it's not like one big blast, you know, from liftoff or deacceleration going into the Mars atmosphere, you know. It's just really two big shocks, you know, on all the systems and the electronics and all the equipment on board that's going to do all the testing for life on the planet. But, you know, have that all bounce on a planet hundreds, maybe dozens of times before it comes to a stop. I don't think that was a great idea. I mean, it worked out, but I mean, this thing sounds better, you know. Come down on rockets with a nice, smooth system. The wheels will be touching right down. No ramps to roll off or bags to get tangled up on, you know, on lines, or, which they had to worry about last time, you know, the last few times. I think they have a shot there. Back to you.
JHR with a historical inquiry. JHR, go right ahead. Give us your name, sir.
Let's see if his name here is Joel. Just a quick historical inquiry. The United States, after World War II, was able to acquire Wernher von Braun, as well as all of his staff. The question I have for you, let's say the Soviets had acquired his staff and von Braun, about how far behind would it have placed us in the space race, since they would have had him and we would not have?
Yeah, John, good question. Willie Lee, Wernher von Braun, the whole crew. That was a lot of brain power at Peenemunde, and we got an awful lot of it. And would we have been able to land Apollo 11 on the moon and have Neil Armstrong say those famous words if that hadn't occurred? I mean, every human being makes some kind of a change in history, whether you know it or not. It has some kind of an effect downrange. And so I think we've been slowed down. Has anyone ever written any articles on the things that you've read on that subject, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Comment.
Okay, they had a guy named Korobu. They had their von Braun, believe me. You didn't know about it until they took down the communist wall. Back to you, and I think John wanted to get in there.
You got it, John.
Yeah, Dick, that whole thing with Peenemünde, that was some arrangement, because the Russians got a few of the missiles, we got most of them. But besides von Braun, he hid his documents, cases, hundreds of cases, in a certain mine area, and he let us know where that was. So we not only got him and his brain power staff, but we got his documentation too. The Russians did not get that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that was a crazy war. And we were scared to death that Germany maybe was also developing the bomb. So we had to develop the bomb as fast as possible to make sure that we didn't develop the bomb second. It could have changed the war. If Doolittle hadn't bombed Tokyo, would that have made a difference? Without that bomb, I think there were huge predictions as to how many soldiers we would have lost in street fighting in Japan, and street fighting would have been required, because without that bomb, I think there would have been no surrender. In fact, at first, there was no surrender on the first bomb. So that was a really rugged adversary, if you know what I mean. They were going to hang in there to the bitter end. Would have been a lot of life lost. So would the Saturn V have looked like the Saturn V without Wernher? Somehow I doubt it. Would we have had the nerve to build it that big? And if a particular very smart engineer at Grumman Aircraft hadn't invented lunar orbit rendezvous as a method of getting the command service module and the lunar module to the moon. Let me drop. If that engineer hadn't invented lunar orbit rendezvous, where only a small portion of the package goes down to the lunar surface, as opposed to the hold-on rocket. All of our science fiction up to that time had you landing with the hold-on rocket on the moon and then the whole thing blast off again. If that's what would have been required, I think the Saturn V would have had to be 4 or 5 times bigger than it was. Already it's a 350-foot high vehicle. I don't know the exact number, but I'm guessing it was something in the vicinity of 6 or 8 million pounds. Let's see now, it had 5.5 million pounds of thrust on takeoff. So it probably had 8 million pounds of mass. 8 million pounds of mass, 5.5 million pounds of thrust was the Saturn V. And without lunar orbit rendezvous, you would have had to build something 4 or 5 times bigger than that. Could we have pulled that off? I don't think so. I don't think there's enough resources on planet Earth to do that and to make it fly right, if you know what I mean.
It was 7 million, wasn't it, Dick?
I'll accept that. I'm giving very rough estimates. You're saying it's 7 million pounds?
Million. I think the, I remember the shuttle was 5.5, I think. I think that's where you get that from. I think the Saturn was 7 million. And the new one coming up, the SLS, is going to be a little bit bigger.
Yeah, when Owen Garriott was speaking from the space shuttle, was it space shuttle? I think it was. During takeoff, he claimed that it was 4 million pounds of thrust, 6 million pounds of mass, something in that order, is the total space shuttle at the instant of takeoff of Cape Canaveral. We're talking about really big numbers here. I mean, I know what 100 feet of tower is like because I climb one. 360 foot of altitude on the command module of Apollo spacecraft. That is a biggie. And so your estimation, Paul, is 7.5 million pounds on takeoff. Is that what you're saying?
I remember that from years ago. I believe it was, because I know the shell was 5.5. So, big numbers. Look how heavy the LEM was. I think that was 250,000 pounds. That thing had to go down to the surface and back up. Now, that thing was as heavy as the shuttle one. About to deorbit the moon and, you know, actually go land on the moon.
Run that by again. The lunar module was made as light as possible. In fact, I know that the astronauts were real worried that if they did something wrong and kicked their foot into the side of the very thin sheet metal, they were afraid they'd go through it and lose the air pressure inside. Once again, Paul, what is your estimation of, what's your memory as to the weight of the lunar module?
Well, the lunar module was probably about half the payload. I think the payload was like 275,000 pounds. So probably, I would guess 150, 200. I don't know. It was heavy, you know, with the fuel and all. Don't forget that thing had to land, and then, you know, with the fuel to slow it down, and then that piece stayed on the moon, and just the top part took off and used the lower landing piece as a launch pad. So, I don't know, probably 100,000 pounds at least, minimum. But, yeah, I know it was very thin. They had to be careful. They had to keep cutting weight, cut the weight when they were building it. It got lighter and lighter. But it looked pretty big. I've seen the thing in person, and I tell you, with fuel and everything, I bet it's got to be 100,000 pounds minimum.
If the payload was 275,000 pounds, and the payload consisted of three things, the command module, the service module, and the lunar module, and the command module, the thing that the astronauts ride back home in, that's pretty big. The service module is another great big chunk behind it with a whole bunch of fuel tanks, and then the lunar module. So you're estimating it's around a third of the total payload, close to 100,000 pounds. Sounds like the right ballpark. When you go to the Cradle of Aviation Museum and you look up that mock-up of the lunar module, it is a rather large object. So 100,000 pounds doesn't sound out of scope, out of capability. We got to research that one, Paul. What a mission. It's going to be a while, though, before we go back to the moon, and you guys have heard me say many times, I don't think our grandchildren are going to see an astronaut from planet Earth standing on Mars. I might be wrong, but that's my belief. Extremely expensive, extremely dangerous, and sending a man there is going to give you more information than you're getting from the robot that you send there. But is it worth... It's 1,000 times more expensive to send a man than to send a robot, and you don't get anywhere near 1,000 times more information if you're willing to pay for it. So it's not cost-effective. So you can tell that I'm rather skeptical. I'd like it to happen, but I think we got to be realistic here. Anybody with further comments on all of the above, give me your call letters right now before we go into the deeper material. K2RW and the TechNet.
You don't need people, Dick. You got those things riding around for the last 7 years on Spirit and Opportunity. Well, no more with Spirit. So look at the data. You got eyes and ears and practically walking capability all those years there.
Well, you said eyes and ears. I'm a little bit disappointed that there aren't more microphones giving you the sound of Mars. I'd like to hear the sound of the wind whistling through the rigging, if you know what I mean. I don't think there's very many microphones on board, Dump Hall. Go ahead.
I went on Phoenix, and they were downloading the noise. But as it was going through the atmosphere, you know, they made a recording. But, you know, I don't think you're going to hear much. I think you would hear maybe the mechanism moving. I don't know. They move so slowly, maybe you wouldn't even hear that. You know? Must be very quiet. But even the wind, you know, they say 100 or 200 mile an hour wind, but it's so thin that it wouldn't even knock you over if you were standing there. So, would you hear it? I don't know.
Yeah, I believe that the Martian atmosphere has something like 0.7% of the air pressure we've got on Earth. So it's a very thin atmosphere. That's true. But I think that atmosphere from time to time moves 200, 250 kilometers per hour, miles per hour, some big number like that. Since wind pressure goes up as a function of velocity squared, even though that's a very tenuous atmosphere, I guarantee that a 200 mile an hour wind of that thin atmosphere is going to make a lot of noise as it whistles through the hardware and blows up the sand. I mean, remember one of the Viking spacecraft when going to Mars at around that time couldn't see any surface details, and they thought that the camera wasn't focused right. There was a huge windstorm that was kicking up the dust. The whole planet was clouded in dust. So they get some pretty wicked winds by my standards. Paul, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, that first Mariner that went into orbit, the ride there, and it was the whole planet was engulfed in dust. They had to wait a couple of weeks or something before they had pictures sent back. And, with all those winds, it never knocked anything over. You know, the rovers kept going along. If you were to take a 200 mile an hour wind and put a rover on the side of a hill somewhere, I think that would have got knocked over. What do you think? Nothing ever happened to them. In fact, it used to help. Sometimes the panels would get so dusty, all the voltage output, the amperage was so low that sometimes you would get a wind that would come by and it would actually clear off the panels, and then they would go up higher in power. So, amazing. You know, I remember that they said, well, why didn't they put some kind of like windshield wipers on there? It turned out they really didn't need it. They'd get dirty, but once in a while, they'd get clean again.
It would be nice to have a brush that brushes across the surface. But now, with the Curiosity having a nuclear power supply, which is probably good for a decade, power to heat the thing during the winter and to run the motors and the cameras, it's all there. That's an expensive way to go, but a good way to go. And I guess that nuclear power supply is probably pretty well shielded to make sure that it's not damaging the nearby electronics, and that electronics is probably all nuclear hardened. Okay, August 5th, 3 a.m. UTC, Curiosity encounters the Martian atmosphere. That's a good day to look forward to. And has anybody estimated how many miles that thing's going to travel, how fast it's going to travel? I mean, is there a slim possibility that it could walk from the equator to the pole if you wanted it to? Paul, what do you think? WS2N, I mean, this thing, if a thing works for 10 years, could it go from the equator to the pole? Mars is what, two-thirds of the diameter of the Earth? WS2N, K2RIW?
Nah, that ain't gonna happen. I think Spirit did a lot of investigating, so did Opportunity. I think combined, I think they've done about 20 miles, 20, a little over 20 miles. Now this is one craft that's gonna land, and I think they said it has capability of going like maybe four times the speed. But they're going to keep they're going to be careful. They're not going to run this thing wide open every day. And it's got autonomous cameras to stop it in case there's a problem. So figure maybe twice the speed. So over, you know, 5-10 years, my guess maybe 30-40 miles, maybe a little bit more than that, if, you know, depending on if they've got a long run. There's nothing to see, you know, I guess I'll keep the pedal to the metal. But, you know, they're going to want to spend a lot of time in one place, you know, investigating certain areas. The month would just go by doing that. They're going to take samples and everything. And this is all going to take forever, every little operation that they do. Back to you.
There's another curiosity question I had, and all of a sudden I've forgotten it. Oh, yes. The primary landing spot, was it particularly chosen because it has a high probability of subsurface water? Because water is the main thing that gives you evidence of past life. So do they choose a place where it either has a lot of water now, subsurface, or is believed to have a lot of water in the past? What do you think, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Pretty near the equator, similar to where Spirit and Opportunity are. Spirit's on one side of the planet, Opportunity's on the other, also near the equator. And they choose these areas because, you know, it is a little, you know, on a rough area. That's what the scientists want. They want to see these outcrops and all of this. Areas where they can, you know, really do good science. They don't want a big flat field like where the two Vikings landed, you know, flat with a lot of rocks. They want to, you know, something interesting, so they're going to Gale Crater near the equator. I think where Phoenix went was very interesting, up north. They had, you know, the ice underneath, and then later on, the winter came, and everything, and eventually killed that. I mean, that's an interesting thing to do. But this thing, near the equator, let me drop it. And most landing sites, the engineers argue with the scientists. The scientists want to go to the tough areas. They go to, what's the name of that one place? It's like the Grand Canyon, the biggest, 3,000 miles long. I'll think of it in a minute. They would go to the bottom of that if they could, but the engineers, they say, no, we want the flattest area, safest place to land on vehicles. But there's always been an ongoing argument, even with the landings on the moon, all the unmanned landing missions and all the manned missions, you know, the same old thing. I mean, when Apollo 11 went, they went to the flattest area that they could find. They just wanted to do it. After that, they wanted to get, you know, real good science back, and they started going to mountainous areas, valleys. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm Googling Grand Canyon on Mars right now, and what in the world? Valles Marineris, I think that's it. Does that sound right? Valles Marineris, is that it, Paul?
Valles Marineris.
Okay. That's a beauty. You may have seen also, probably old news, but I just saw it this week, that the, I've forgotten the name of the mission that's at Mercury. Mercury is very close to the sun, like one-third of our orbital distance.
Messenger, Dick.
What was that again?
Messenger.
The Messenger. I think they've discovered quite a few of the craters at the poles contain ice in the corner of the crater that's always being shadowed, even though the average temperature of Mercury is some ridiculous temperature, like 800 degrees Fahrenheit, I think it is. Still, the poles are in continuous shadow, and there appears to be ice in the shadow of the craters at the pole. Have you seen that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I haven't heard that verified. I know they were looking for it, similar to what they have on the moon. You know, they found hydrogen signs on the moon, the north and south crater. Craters, North Pole and South Pole. So, sounds like the same thing, but if it's verified, that's very good. But I don't think we're going to be landing there anytime soon to utilize that. But we might on the moon. But 800 degrees average, I don't think so. It's a little cooler than Venus, but not much.
Well, if you land at the poles, you stand a chance, but gotta choose your place very carefully. What's the best guess, Paul, as to when mankind goes back to the moon, or is Japan or some other country heading for the moon, to your knowledge, over to you, Paul?
They all got grandiose ideas. Japan, India, even China wants to, well, they want to build a space station and go to the moon at the same time, so I think they all got their hands full. We had the best chance with the Constellation program, and that was canceled. I think the next time you see a lunar landing, I don't think it's going to be by the Orion spacecraft people. You would think it would be, you know. They want to send people off to the asteroids. They don't even want to go back to the moon. You know, that would be NASA. But my guess, the next shot would be commercial landing. I mean, you're looking at 30 minutes, maybe 30 years down the road, Dick. I don't know. Hopefully not. But yeah, you might see a foreign country do it before us.
I think there's already in place an international agreement that nobody owns the moon. Nobody can stake a claim there. It's owned by everybody. So if you go there, you're going for scientific reasons to investigate the regolith and look at what the soil is like, how many impacts of craters it's had, whether there's water at the poles, and so on. Other than national pride, although there's been lots of discussions over the last few months about mining asteroids, I'm a little skeptical of this one. When you look at the price of getting a spacecraft to an asteroid, if it contains gold and platinum and silver and everything else that you consider valuable, uranium, can you really mine those substances and bring it back to the Earth? And do you come out with a positive cash flow? This is our last subject on space, Paul. Do you think you got an opinion on mining of the asteroids? WS2N, KQRIW.
No way. I mean, you could do it, but it's going to cost you a fortune. I mean, there's nothing there that they could bring back that's going to be worth it. It's not like they're going to find, you know, something new on the periodic table that they could use. it's going to be, look, you know, we landed there first, and that's what they want to do. They don't want to have the Russians. I mean, that was one of the Russians' goals, is to land on an asteroid first. DARPA, make sure that the government goes on a straight, narrow path when it comes to things like this. They know what Russia's got in their head. They might be 10, 20, 30 years down the road for the Russians, who knows, but that's what they have planned. And DARPA is in charge of not, you know, that's how the agency got started. They got started because, you know, Sputnik, we didn't want to ever be caught off guard again like that. No more surprises. So DARPA was set up to make sure that never happened. So I think that's what they have in mind. We went to the moon, so we could say we were there first. We'll go to the asteroids. We'll go to Mars, probably with either with us or maybe a multi-nation deal like the International Space Station. And nobody owns the moon yet. It's a deal just like Antarctica, Dick.
Fun stuff. Keep up the good work, Paul. Somebody want to say something?
2XJN.
Yeah, Dick, comment on life form on Earth here when we get our chance.
Okay, I was also going to go to over here. You've done some very nice directional coupler measurements over the last couple of weeks. And what can directional couplers really be used for? Why are they so valuable? Why does the front end of both ports of a vector network analyzer contain one? By the way, the Zebra Victor Charlie Echo. Yeah, Zebra Victor Charlie Echo is the inexpensive, 10-year-old, roughly, Rode and Schwartz vector network analyzer, so-called economy model. I think it does everything you want to do, and I think that could save you a fortune compared to some of the other models of other brand names that you've been looking at. That's the exact model I have used every day of my life for all these antenna experiments I've done for the last 8 years, Paul. It's a whole lot of patents that were done with that exact machine. It leaves very little to be desired. And you've heard me say in the past, I can calibrate it in February. Don't turn it off if I don't want to, all year long. I checked the calibration in December, and it's near perfect. What a machine. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Yes, Dick, I've written that model number down, and I'm going through trying to find, roughly the prices and things like that. But that looks like a very nice instrument. I know there are some outboard products that you have provided to other things with it, but I don't think I would need them for the work that I'm doing. Oh, by the way, I found out what that reference level nonsense was. You're not going to believe that.
Fire away.
Well, first of all, basically you were right. It has absolutely nothing to do with the interpretation of the signals on the screen. And this stupid thing should be turned off when not used. What that's telling you is where the calibration was set. So if you go to the 10 dB position, minus 10 dB position, it'll tell you reference level minus 10 dB. That's where you did the calibration. Once you take it out of calibration, that screen onset should be turned off, but they don't. So it had nothing to do with what we were talking about. Just thought you'd like that.
Sure would. It is my belief that an awful lot of the vector network analyzers wake up in the minus 10 dBm calibration mode. You get a little bit more dynamic range if you ran 0 dBm, but you're now using less attenuation after your source, and therefore the source standing wave ratio won't be quite as good. And there are some transistors that you might measure, some amplifiers, for instance, that would saturate at 0 dBm. So minus 10 is a nice round ballpark figure where you get good impedance of your attenuators and sources and loads. You get 70 dB or so of dynamic range before you do exotic things. And it's a low enough level that except for measuring a 50 dB gain amplifier, you're not going to saturate it. So I think a lot of them wake up at minus 10. What do you think, Paul? I mean, here we go, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW. And what's the next subject you believe we should be discussing that you and Wes probably have already lined one up? You got it, John.
No, that we haven't done yet, KC2WGB. My analyzer is manual. If I leave it set on 0 dBm, when I wake up, it's still set at 0 dBm. So that's a little inconvenient. I'm sure the later ones do exactly what you said. The only thing I wanted to bring up was there was a gentleman, a PhD out of one of the science institutes, who went to a location on Earth that has rocks that are 3.6 billion years old, and they found life form inside the rocks when they cut them open. So life did not start as late as we think on Earth. It started pretty early. These microorganisms were discovered. I saw the program today on the Discovery Channel. Very interesting. If you see that go by on PBS, take a look at that. Very, very good stuff.
And what's the name of the program, John?
I think it was called The Planets.
Okay, I'll keep an eye out for that one. And now, do you want to discuss a little bit of your directional couplers? I think there's some awful good information there.
6DPZ with cutoff.
You got it, Hal.
Good morning, Dick, John. I just read the mail a little bit. I have a good question. I'm going to throw it both of you. I came up with a way, but I want to hear two mavens' ways of doing it. How can you accurately get 1 microvolt and know that it's a measured accurate 1 microvolt? Go ahead, Dick.
Now I'm going to guess you want 1 microvolt on a 50 ohm system. And 1 microvolt is minus 107 dBm. The most accurate thing for setting power level is a power meter. Essentially, no power meter will go to minus 107 dBm. I think rarely does a power meter have any accuracy left when you get below minus 50 dBm on a power meter. So therefore, I think you have no choice but to start off with something that you can easily measure the power of accurately. like minus 30 dBm, you can measure very accurately with a good power meter. Minus 107.